The headlines. Iran says it will not accept any proposal in the Vienna talks that go beyond the framework of the JCPOA. The Yemeni military says its air defenses shot down a Saudi spy drone over the Flashpoint province of Marib. And New Zealanders rally in Wellington against COVID vaccine mandates and lockdowns. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in Iranian capital Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this sapphire, Iran says it won't accept any proposal in the Vienna talks that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has told United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres that Tehran is ready to negotiate a good deal. Iran's top diplomat has blamed the slow progress in the talks on the Western party's lack of initiative, while noting that threats have never worked in the case of Iran. Amir Abdollahian says Iran has allowed cameras to be replaced at its Karaj centrifuge complex after the UN nuclear watchdog denounced a sabotage attack there. He described the move as Iran's goodwill gesture. Guterres, for his part, has voiced support for the process in Vienna to revive the JCPOA. Iran and Hungary are looking to expand their ties, and their foreign ministers have indicated that by putting their signatures to several cooperation agreements. Earlier today, Hossein Amir Abdollahian and Peter Siarto signed 5 documents on cultural, diplomatic, and customs cooperation as they met in Tehran. The two countries' economic commissions will also regularly meet to work out ways to increase the trade volume. Hungary is donating 100,000 vaccines to Tehran. According to Amir Abdollahian, Iran will use the vaccines to inoculate 4 million Afghan refugees who are living in the country. Siarto said Iran can have a very constructive role in stopping the influx of Afghan refugees to Europe. And regarding Iran's 2015 deal with world powers, he said Hungary supports talks on the revival of the agreement. Yemen's military says it has shot down an intruding Saudi spy drone over the province of Marib. Air defense batteries targeted the violating aircraft that was flying over Yemeni territory. Meanwhile, fighting continues on the ground. The Yemeni army and popular forces have been making gains against forces tied to the Saudi coalition. In a pincer attack on Wednesday, they managed to capture strategic heights close to Marib. Elsewhere in the northeastern province of Jowf, the Yemeni forces engaged in heavy fighting with Saudi border troops and repelled them. They also took control of several positions in the strategic Qashan mountain range. The fighting resulted in casualties on both sides. Our correspondent in San Abdulatif al-Washali has been following the developments in Yemen. Here's his update on the situation.
Yesterday, there was a crime committed in Taiz. The Saudi fighter just killed 2 civilians, including 1 children. The Yemenis are only defending themselves when it comes to the Saudi war. They are attempting to force Saudi Arabia to stop its years-long war and siege. The Yemeni army is defending the country. They have yesterday launched another attack against Saudi Arabia. They attacked only the hangars of the aircraft in King Khalid Air Base. There are no civilians killed in the Yemeni attacks. There are no civilians injured in the Yemeni attacks. So Yemenis are aware where to hit. On the contrary, Saudi Arabia is only targeting Yemeni civilians and not achieving anything. They failed during 7 years of war. They are only using their weapons to kill more civilians. The Scan Eagle was hovering over Abida Valley in Marib, and as it is hovering over that area, I believe that this area has been liberated by the Yemeni army, and we will know this in the few coming days when it becomes announced by the spokesman of the Yemeni army.
Lebanon says it will soon deport members of a Bahraini opposition group. All non-Lebanese members of Al-Wafaq movement must now leave the country. You don't know when exactly the deportations will start. Also, it's not yet clear where the Bahraini nationals will be sent. Interior Minister Bassam Malawi says Lebanon will not be used as a platform to spread hate towards other Arab countries. A few days ago, Al-Wafaq held a press conference in Beirut. There, it released a report detailing rights abuses in Bahrain between 2016 in 2021, the group was Bahrain's main opposition party until the judiciary dissolved it 5 years ago. For a decade now, Bahrain has been the scene of anti-regime demonstrations. Protesters say they want to see a just system representing all Bahrainis take the place of the Ona Khalifa rulers. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, says Lebanon's interior minister has not consulted other cabinet ministers on the decision to expel Al-Wafal members. Let's take a listen.
Well, we don't know exactly why the interior minister took this decision just like that, unilaterally. We know that other ministers have not been basically consulted, but this was probably a decision made between the interior minister and the prime minister, Najib Mikati. And this was quite a surprise for the Lebanese, because in general, Lebanon has always been a safe haven or an area where thinkers, free thinkers, even opposition members of all the country, all the Arab countries come to Lebanon, because this is considered basically a country where they are free to speak their mind or publish their books. And this is why it was quite a surprise, especially coming now when the Wafaq group has been in Lebanon since 2011, since the Bahraini regime expelled them from Bahrain, even removing their citizenship. So these people have no citizenship. They live in Lebanon because Lebanon gives them that right to either work and live here as an opposition.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the wall Israel has built along the Gaza Strip won't bring security to the regime. This comes after Israel claimed that the recently completed Iron Wall will deny Hamas a key capability by blocking its tunnels. We have more in this report from Gaza.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has dismissed the Israeli claim that the regime's iron wall will block one of the capabilities Hamas tried to develop. The group says no wall can bring security and safety for Israel. Israel recently completed an iron wall along the Gaza Strip. Hamas says this represents an Israeli retreat in its weak points. Hamas also stressed that it will continue to improve its strategic capabilities based on its previous experience of war with Israel.
Building this iron wall surrounding the Gaza Strip is an aggressive act that aims to worsen the blockade and suffocate Palestinians. However, this reflects the Israeli regime's weakness in facing Palestinians. Past records prove that the resistance is able to break all obstacles Israel is putting up before us.
Israel announced the completion of a massive iron wall around the besieged Gaza Strip above and below ground last week. The wall, the regime touted as technologically advanced, aims to counter the tunnels Hamas used to blindside Israeli troops during their 2014 war on Gaza.
The Israeli regime completed the building of the Iron Wall around the Gaza Strip, making the enclave the world's largest prison. This wall is built while Gazans are already living under harsh conditions in all aspects of their life due to the inhumane blockade imposed against them. There is no freedom of movement here for Gazans, and Israel is ignoring international conventions.
For 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, the wall is a confirmation that they live in the world's largest open-air prison. That's against the backdrop of the UN comments that the wall makes Gaza unlivable, and Palestinians fears that their condition will further worsen.
We have been under an Israeli siege for a long time, and the suffering increases day by day. Palestinians are the victims of all sorts of Israeli violations. The blockade has suffocated Palestinians, and this is what the Israeli regime wants. This wall is another Israeli attempt to force Palestinians to give up their rights.
Critics say this iron wall is a collective punishment for 2 million Palestinians who are already living under a crippling Israeli blockade imposed 15 years ago on the impoverished enclave. They say the Gaza Strip is the world's largest open-air prison now. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Members of the European Parliament debate the dire health and economic consequences resulting from the resurgence of COVID-19 across the 27-country bloc. The lawmakers are divided over the idea of making the vaccinations compulsory. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
With an average of 1,500 people dying from COVID-19 in the EU each day, the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has told the bloc's lawmakers that a strategy is needed to tackle vaccine scepticism. It's no secret that von der Leyen is in favour of making it mandatory for people to take the jab, but not everyone is in agreement.
Scientists also disagree on vaccination for young and healthy people. It is insane to make this mandatory. And how about transparency? Why are the vaccine contracts between the European Commission and the vaccine manufacturers so secret?
Legislators insist the EU needs to send billions of vaccines to Africa and also share manufacturing patents.
Without redoubling our efforts in this area, we risk seeing emerging variants with every letter of the Greek alphabet, with all the devastation that comes with them.
As hospitals in the EU fill up, businesses are emptying out. The economy is really struggling. In Belgium, just like in most EU countries, more restrictions are being imposed. Everything here has to shut at 11 p.m.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
Other citizens have been reacting to new requirements for travelling between EU member states.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
The EU has been criticised for banning travel from countries in southern Africa after the Omicron variant was detected by South Africa.
The EU needs to put in place proportionate measures instead of punishing the most transparent and cooperative countries. The EU needs to consult before we take decisions like travel bans.
The fact that 150 million adults in the EU are refusing to take a vaccine shows that a huge number of citizens do not trust their political leaders or the bloc's institutions, some lawmakers suggest. Apparently, this is because the EU has let people down previously on a whole range of other issues. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
COVID vaccine mandates and lockdowns are facing protests from a part of the population in New Zealand. The growing anger has drawn thousands into the streets of Wellington. The protesters, mostly unmasked, marched through the central business district and gathered in front of the parliament. Security was beefed up outside to the building with entrances closed off and dozens of police deployed. COVID infections and deaths have been low in New Zealand thanks to tough lockdowns and massive immunization programs, with 90% now fully vaccinated. But the plans have also drawn criticism from people who want more freedoms and an end to mandatory vaccines. A super typhoon is battering the Philippines after forcing the evacuation of tens of thousands of people. Rai is now a Category 5 storm, the highest classification. It's packing maximum winds of 260 kilometers an hour. More than 45,000 people have already fled their homes seeking emergency shelter. Scores of flights have been canceled and dozens of ports temporarily closed. The storm has the potential to cause life-threatening flooding in low-lying coastal areas. This is the second super typhoon to threaten the Philippines this year. An average of 20 storms and typhoons hit the Philippines every year. Millions of Americans are under a weather alert in central and northern parts of the United States, where strong winds are fueling another wave of extreme weather. The National Weather Service is warning against potential tornadoes and continued storms in several states. That's rather unseasonal for this time of the year. The powerful winds are causing widespread damage, leaving hundreds of thousands without electricity. Officials are urging residents in the states of Iowa and Minnesota to take shelter. The hurricane-force winds are also battering Kentucky, where a tornado disaster killed dozens of people less than a week ago. President Joe Biden visited the state on Wednesday and pledged to rebuild the devastated communities. Some of the locals, though, did not seem very keen about his visit.
Personally, the less government I see, the better. Because red tape and all the things that come along with it, we'd just rather do it ourselves and be self-sufficient.
Yeah, so there's no help right at the moment at all. You know, maybe the individuals in the community have been helping. They've been bringing food and clothes and stuff like that, but I haven't seen anybody from the government, so I don't know.
Over 500 National Guard members are currently deployed in Kentucky to assist victims in search operations, where more than 100 people are still unaccounted for. Friday's tornadoes also affected the states of Tennessee, Arkansas, and Missouri, where a total of 14 people have been reported dead. Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki defends the Islamic movement in Nigeria, noting that its sole mission is to raise people's awareness. Zanjum Abdullah has the details from Abuja.
Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki says the Islamic movement aims to raise awareness about Islam. He says malevolent intent is behind the allegations that the IMN is an association. He asked the media to stop referring to his supporters as if they are members of an organization, explaining that they are just activists.
We don't have membership card, right? You don't register to become part of Islam. Once you are active, you are just active. That's all. It's open for all Muslims, not only Muslims. It is open even to non-Muslims. You may know that, maybe you don't know. There is Christian forum of the Islamic movement. What happened?
Sheikh Zazaki said many Nigerians have marked the 6th anniversary of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds of his supporters were murdered in cold blood by security forces. He said the extent of the heinous crimes committed during the massacre is beyond comprehension, as the attack was completely unprovoked.
We are running a kind of hospital in that Husseinia, the center. They murdered all the patients and all the nurses and all the doctors. Over 1,000 people were murdered in 3 days, and they all carried all their bodies and dumped them in different mass graves. Even a dead person has a right to be buried according to his religious belief.
Nigerians from diverse cultural backgrounds convened to attend the public lecture to mark the 6th anniversary of the massacre. The hearing for a suit challenging the confiscation of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife's passports will be held on January 18.
Meanwhile, the Islamic cleric said he will have to stay with a dangerous bullet shrapnel in his body. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
The U.S. Congress votes to launch a commission to study failures of the 20-year war in Afghanistan that came to an end with the chaotic withdrawal of American troops last summer. The panel is part of a $768 billion annual defense package passed by the Senate 89-10. The Commission on America's Longest War will have 16 members. It has to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting and a final one in 3 years. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 led to the ouster of the Taliban, but the group rose to power again in August as foreign forces were leaving the war-torn country. According to the U.S. Defense Department, the war has cost American taxpayers some $955 billion. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Following the Holy Prophet in Islamic morality.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
پیروی از پیغمبر در اخلاق که خدای متعال فرمود انک لعلی خلق عظیم.
As for ethics and morality, we should follow the Holy Prophet's example in ethics. God, the Exalted, said, and you stand on an exalted standard of character. The Holy Quran, Surah 68, verse 4. Something that our Creator has said is an exalted standard of character. It's something extraordinary, and you stand on an exalted standard of character. Such morality should always receive our attention and be a guideline for us. We should behave in an Islamic way and be humble and forgiving. These are examples of Islamic ethics. We should be tolerant in personal matters. Of course, being tolerant is not permissible with regards to public matters and that which is related to the rights of the people. But in the case of personal matters, we can be tolerant. We should be kind towards others and avoid lying, insulting, and having doubts about the believers. We should also forgive the believers. One of the supplications in Sahifa Sajjadiya says, O God, I forgive everyone who has done an act of injustice towards me, who has said an untrue thing about me, and whom I can bring to justice. This is Imam Sajjad's supplication, Sahifa Sajjadiya. These are examples of Islamic ethics. We should carry out our duties in this regard.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Dear brothers, dear sisters, we have to act and we have to take action. Issues do not end with claims. We claim to be Muslims. We claim to be the Islamic Republic. Therefore, we must be truly Islamic. We must follow the Holy Prophet. This great blessed anniversary of this birth is an opportunity to think about and study this issue and to show our true determination on this path. I congratulate all of you again. I congratulate the dear Iranian nation. I congratulate all the Muslims throughout the world and the Islamic nation. I congratulate all the liberated people in the world. And I send greetings to the pure souls who were martyred on the path of Islam and the path of the school of the Prophet. I send greetings to the pure soul of our magnanimous Imam who opened up this path to us and who guided us towards this great endeavor. I ask God the Exalted to bestow His paradise and His mercy on all of them. And I ask Him to bestow success on the people of Iran, in particular on you, officials, on you, dear guests, and on us. Greetings be upon you, and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong Indeed you gave me hope, oh Allah I wanna thank you I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done You've done for
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So, they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ebrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as the root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
The British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. During his High Court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances, because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot. They just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction, because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over. Whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, there were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the UK or other parts of the world may now be brought to the US for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the US is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom. On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and airstrikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions. Clearly, those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They are two nations that are in a very strategic area to border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom, or the European Union, or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowadays, Hausawi students, everybody who enters in the Hausa, are benefiting from the students who were nurtured by Ayatollah Saadat Parvez.
No, he was participating and accompanying Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayhi more than 30 years. And here is the turning point in his life.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it? Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio. Very welcome to the program, The Teacher. The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars, philosophers, spiritual trainers, and jurists during the history of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Zainia. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Zainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah to you and to your dear listeners.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure who has spent most of his life in nurturing the students regarding spirituality and akhlaq or ethics. One of the most outstanding students of Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. He is no one but the late Ayatollah Haj Sheikh Ali Saadat Parvar, mainly known as Pahlevani Tehrani. Okay, Sheikh Zainia, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of the late Ayatollah Haj Sheikh Ali Saadat Parvar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sheikh Ali Saadat Parvar, also famous as Pahlevani Tehrani, Rahmatullah Alayh, was born in 1305 in solar calendar in the city of Tehran in Iran. And his birthday was coincident with the day of the birthday of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay.
And he was born in a religious family. And because, you know, Tehran on those days was not a good city for, you know, studying for a religious family, studying in schools. So that's why he entered a special school that was held in a mosque and started having Islamic studies. That these schools were called maktab at those times.
Or schools, per se. That's
yeah.
Okay.
He learned the preliminary studies of Islamic, you know, seminary in Tehran, like, for example, Arabic literature and some books regarding fiqh and usulul fiqh, but, you know, introductory ones like ma'alim and lum'a. And he was very eager to have a travel to Atabat Aliyat, I mean, Najaf al-Ashraf and Karbala and Samarra and Kazimain. And he had this chance, you know, it was very hard in those times to have this, you know, ziyarat for normal people because the travel, you know, facilities was really hard. So, but he had this chance to have a caravan with some young men from Tehran, and they went to do ziyarat. And after that, he came to the Islamic Seminary of Qom and started studying there. And here is the turning point in his life that he gets familiar with a very noble figure, a great one, no one but late Allama Tabatabai Rahmatullah Alayh, that has come to this city, to this, the city of Qom, to teach Islamic studies to good students.
That's all right. Really enjoying the presence of Allama Tabatabai had direct role, Sheikh Mahdavi, in shaping the very character of Ayatollah Saadat Parvar. Talk a little bit about this.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, this is really important if we get this chance and tawfiq to accompany somebody like Allama Tabatabai for more than 30 years. Some books have recorded that 40 years he was accompanying Allama Tabatabai in all sessions, private sessions, public sessions. Okay. So the result of such tawfiq is nothing but standing or being regarded as the late scholar representing the school of thought that might be known as the school of thought of Mullah Hussain Ghulia Hamedani.
Right.
Nowadays, people, or better to say, scholars, if they want to highlight someone as the one who is representing this school of thought, they name Ayatollah Saadat Parvar or Pahlavani. And this is not achievable except through hardship, I mean hardship in terms of training, self training,
yes,
going through very difficult spirituality and experiences, spiritual experiencing and exercising, better to say spiritual exercising. Yes.
Self-purification.
Yes, and self-purification.
Okay.
So he reached the level that even he is compared with Mullah Hussein Quli Hamedani in terms of nurturing different students. That nowadays, Hauzavi students, everybody who enters in the Hauza, are benefiting from the students who were nurtured by him. Okay. I mean, Ayatollah Saadat Parvar. This is a very important character because we had a lot of ulama, a lot of scholars, but in terms of nurturing several students and bringing up students to their level, this is something which is mentioned for Mullah Hussein Quli Hamedani and then for Allama Saadat Parvar.
Sorry, is it true that Ayatollah Saadat Parvar got a specific permission from Allama Tawatawi to nurture the students? And is it at all a kind of, I mean, routine work of the, I mean, trainers, spiritual trainers, in order to give some of the students this ijaza of nurturing the students on spirituality and akhlaq?
Yes, definitely this is true. And in order to understand this and try to digest this importance, we have to talk about the same thing that we have in Fiqh Usul and Rawaya. When we say that that scholar has got the permission of Rivaya, the other scholar has got the permission of Ijtihad. So when it comes to morality and Irfan in its specific term, it requires permission. This is not the easy field to be taken by everybody. Because through the way of training others, there are a lot of dangers coming through the shaitan, temptation coming through the shaitan that may affect the teacher himself. So without this permission, those great ones, those who were who had this concern for themselves, they wouldn't enter this field. So Allama Saadat Parvar is one of those who's got this permission to have this chance and tawfiq to nurture different students in this field.
So when we are talking about spiritual training and this spiritual wayfaring and enjoying the presence of Allama Tabatabai, what do we mean exactly? I mean, how Ayatollah Saadat Parvar enjoyed the presence of Allama?
You know, he was participating and accompanying Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayhi more than 30 years. And he himself says that, I did not miss the class of Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayhi and his gathering unless only I missed 2 days. And one of them was the day that, if I'm not mistaken, his daughter got married. And the other day is that he says that there was snowy weather and I was going to participate in the class and I saw a Sayyid old man is trying to cleanse the snow from above his house or in front of his house. I witnessed him and he was trying to do this, you know, process and it was very hard for him. So at that moment this came to my mind that my teacher, I mean Allama Tawatawi rahmatullah alayhi, for sure is more satisfied with me to help to this old Sayyid rather than participating in the class.
Very good.
So he decides to not to participate in the class but helping that old Sayyid.
That's right.
So it is very important to have, you know, a determined will and not to leave the scene easily.
Yes.
So he says that I just missed 2 sessions.
Yes.
And this is very unique about him.
That's right. And so many of the works that Ayatollah Saadat Parvar compiled are somehow related to the spiritual circles that he attended with Allama Tabatabai, especially Jamal Aftab, you know, related to elaboration on the ghazals or the sonnets of Hafiz, also some of the rivayat and ayat that have been explicated by Allama Tabatabai. Raz-e Dil or the secret of the heart is another one, you know, which is an elaboration exegesis on Gulshan Raz on Sheikh Mahmud Shabestari, again in the spiritual sessions that he attended with Allama Tabatabai. Also Pasdaran Harim Ishq or the safeguards of the sanctuary of love, this is the rough translation of course, which is related somehow again to the guidelines, spiritual trainings, educational trainings when at the presence of Allama Tabatabai, and so many, you know, other works
which are related to spirituality. He was among the spiritual trainers who has quite fruitful compilations too, because so many of the Orafa maybe have one, two books, you know, but his books are really many. He has also a book regarding the Qayba of Imam Mahdi, isn't it? What is that book?
Ash-Shumus al-Mudiyah. This is the book. Okay.
This is in Arabic?
Yes, this is what is the title? He has compiled. He has compiled all the riwayat regarding the issue or regarding the Imam Zaman alayhi salam.
Okay.
Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
The quality of the occultation or something like that?
Everything.
Okay.
In terms of his birth and the place he was born, the close companions, the minor occultation, and after that, everything which is in relation to Baqiyatullah al-Azam.
That's all right.
You know, even sometimes we think that these figures always are giving odd instructions to people.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, for example, recite this dhik 10 times, that one 100 times, that one 50 times, that one 70 times. Then you will see something, you know, brilliant into the sky, and you have to follow it. Maybe we think like this regarding these moral figures. But it's very important that he says to his students that you have to be in good mood and good behavior with your family, and especially with your wife.
That's all right.
He says, even though, for example, the food that she has prepared for you is not suitable with your favor, you have to be thankful toward her and thank her. And he says that once I got angry with my family, with my wife, when I was young.
That's right.
And I was told in a way that 20 years of your actions was vanished because you got angry with your wife.
That's right.
So, you know, trying to
socialize with the people around
and to implement the orders of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam regarding have good temper with family, with neighbors, with people, and loving them. These orders are very important to be a pious and moral person.
So being pious, does that mean being secluded and following a solitary life in confinement? It means being among the people, at the same time have self-account and take care of your soul. That's all right. And you know, sometimes the people have to take care about some of the fake mystical movements that are followed here and there under the name of such scholars like Ayatollah Saadat Parvar Allama Tabatabai or Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai. You know, for sure this line had its own permissions and license, and there are some serious content to be taught in this way. Not everyone who can do some we can say illusion, or it's better to say magical action, can be called an RF or a mystic. For sure, Islamic Shiite mysticism must be in the framework of the Shariat and the obligations that are recommended by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Prophet Muhammad, and the infallible Imams.
May I add something?
Okay.
I think it's better to say, or on top of what you brothers said, that there are some easy tasks but difficult to be done. Mm-hmm. For example, when we look at Ayatollah Saadat Parvar, we see that he has entitled with different names: Saadat Parvar, Tehrani, Pahlavani.
Okay.
One of his students was once explaining for us why he has three different names.
Okay.
So, before we say what was the explanation behind this type of names which has nothing to do with each other, he was saying, we have to mention this point, that this field of spirituality is really subject to dangers like being famous.
Oh.
So these people were trying to escape from getting famous and popular among people. What nowadays everybody is trying to do through his profile in Instagram, Telegram, here and there.
Yes.
So fame in and of itself is dangerous for our spirituality.
Okay.
So somebody who is stepping on this path, for him, it's